Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love it.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to the detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, y'all know him, man.
I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to get nobody a second chance. Trump.
To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate it.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald faith truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Bobby Richardson is now joining us on the radio show. Thank you, sir, for making time.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I'm 80. I'll be 81 in August, but you know what? I just feel young, and I enjoy it so much, playing baseball, coaching baseball on the college level, and now in retirement, I'm enjoying it. Coastal Carolina won this year. I even coached there and was the athletic director down at that school on the beach, and they came out on top in the College World Series this year.
What does it make you feel like when you hear stories of people who followed you and were just rabid fans, and people who come up to you or maybe write you a letter and say, Bobby, oh, you were just my hero, and you know, I followed you. What does that feel like to you now?
Well, it's honestly humbling. And I was thinking about this afternoon. I have a daughter that helps me with my mail. And I do get some wonderful letters, and they're from different people. And most of my mail today comes from young boys whose father was a Yankee fan, whose grandfather was a Yankee fan. And they, of course, have not seen me play, but on the Internet they can tell me all my stats. And it's amazing that I would actually get 5, 6, 7 a day after 50 years from retirement with baseball.
1960, you guys win the World Series. You're the World Series MVP. What do you remember from that series?
Well, I remember we were in the clubhouse after the game, and Mantle was crying. And he was crying because he thought we had a better team and should have won. We actually should have won the sixth game. There was a bad hop that hit Kubek in the throat that turned that that particular game around. And then in the seventh game, we were tied, and Mazeroski hit the ball out of the park, and we indeed had lost. And Mantle was crying, and about that time, Sport Magazine came in and said to me, you've been nominated as the most valuable player. Well, I didn't think that could happen, number one. And then I have had a couple letters from some pirates saying, you're driving my Corvette. The sad part is I took it home, couldn't get my family in, and traded it for a Jeep. And my son now said, Dad, I can't believe you did that. But I did.
You outscored the Pirates 55-27 in that seven-game series. You out-hit them 91-60. You out-homered them 10-4. Your team ERA was twice as low. And yet, Mazeroski's walk-off home run ends up being, you know, the difference maker. Statistics, not always honest, are they?
Well, they aren't, and let's just go 2 years after that, and who is the pitcher pitching to McCovey? Same guy that hit the home run, Ralph Terry, that Mazeroski hit the home run off him. Had McCovey's ball been a little bit higher, he would have had that happen twice, but I just happened to be in the right place. The ball had an overspin on it, came down in a hurry. McCovey, I didn't see him for 45 years after that 62, and they were at New Candlestick Park. They asked me to come out, and I honestly, it's a long ways all the way across country, but Alvin Dark called me and said, hey, listen, he lives in South Carolina at that time. He's deceased now, but he said, you need to go. And they wanted McCovey and I to speak at a banquet, and both of us throw out the first ball the next day. They were in interleague play playing the Yankees. And so I did go, and when I saw him for the first time, his comment to me was, I bet your hand is still hurting. He did hit it hard, and I told him that. I said, you hit it hard, and he really did.
What was it like to be in that Yankees clubhouse with the personalities and the legends that were in there at the time? Were you aware that these were legends?
Not really. I think I came up as a 17-year-old right out of high school for a three-day workout at the stadium. Put on the uniform, walked out, fielded some ground balls, stood around a cage to take some swings before the ball game, and then I'd go up and sit in the stands. And I realized then that Mantle and Rizzuto and Yogi Berra and Whitey Ford were outstanding players. I'd seen the film Pride of the Yankees, and the Yankees became the ball club that I followed, and they actually had spring training in my hometown. They're my league club. And when I was 15 years old, Mayo Smith said, hey, when you graduate, I'll see to it you have a chance to sign with the Yankees. And so when I came up as a 19-year-old to play, that's when I really was awe-inspired by those. And I remember that Mantle, on that first day in the dugout, said, hey, Rich, he said, come over here, and I'm going to point like I'm showing you the stadium. And before 2 minutes will pass by, there'll be some photographers over here, and you'll have your picture in all the New York papers tomorrow. Well, that's exactly what happened. And the next day I was able to send home some newspapers to my folks back in South Carolina and say, hey, here I am.
We're talking to Bobby Richardson, former Yankees second baseman. You mentioned Yogi Berra. Your first All-Star game that you play in is in 1957 at Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. And you walk in and Yogi Berra is in there and he's in his 10th All-Star game, or he plays in 10 in his career. And Ted Williams is in there and Mantle, of course. And what'd you think as you looked around and realized you were in this room and you belonged there?
Well, I'm not sure I knew that I belonged at that time. I was picked to be one of the substitutes by my manager, and I was honored that he thought enough of me to do that. But you're right. That is awe-inspiring. And when you get accumulation of the All-Stars from all the teams in one location, I think one of my biggest thrills is that I've been privileged and humbled to have the prayer of dedication in Cooperstown for three of my opponents. One was Johnny Bench when he was inducted in the Hall of Fame. One was Nellie Fox, and one was Phil Rizzuto. And on all of those occasions, sitting backstage with all the Hall of Fame, and I remember one time that I was sitting by Johnny Bench, and Ted Williams came in a wheelchair, came over to me, stood up, and we have something in common. We both love hunting and fishing, and he and I had talked over the years about that. And he started a conversation about hunting. Stan Musial joined. Yogi came over, and Stan Musial came over. And Johnny Bench got up and shot a picture of the four of us. And, man, oh, man, he sent me that picture. I got it on my wall here. And it's humbling but inspiring.
You officiated Mickey Mantle's funeral. The magnitude of an event like that, the gravity of it, how do you stay focused and not let that sort of overwhelm you as you're officiating and sort of closing the loop on his life?
Well, number one, he was the icon of baseball during my time. And we didn't go out together. We were wonderful teammates. He's been to my home on six occasions. We had a little place in North Carolina together at Grandfather Mountain. He came to the University of South Carolina when I coached and gave a batting exhibition to eight-year-old boys. And we had been together a lot, but it was at Roger Maris's funeral when, after the funeral was over, so cold in Fargo, North Dakota, got on a motorhome going back to the hotel, and Mickey Mantle sat down by me. I had been privileged and asked by Roger's wife to have a part in his funeral, and he looked at me and he said, I want you to have my funeral. Didn't think it ever happened, don't remember my answer, but later, a wonderful, poignant interview on national television, and Mickey Mantle had been through Betty Ford. He said, I don't drink anymore, and I'm no hero. Took so much courage for him to say that at that time. But to make it short, every time I saw him, he said, don't forget. And it was humbling, but I had to make all the arrangements, find the church, have Bob Costas come, and do all of the things. I asked Roy DeClark to come and be a part of that program. And Mickey's family sent each one of the pallbearers and Bob Kotsis and myself a Mickey Mantle glove encased in glass with a wonderful verse on it. And so it's humbling. But, I just, as I look back, I've had seven of my teammates' funeral. I'm not a pastor, just a Christian. But each one in different occasions asked me to have a part in their funeral, including my manager, Ralph Houck, who was with me my whole career.
Eight-time All-Star, five-time Gold Glove Award winner. Bobby Richardson, former Yankees second baseman, is our guest. The, 167 Major League players have spent their entire careers with one team. Of all the thousands and thousands of players, 167 guys spent their whole career. You were a Yankee for your whole career. What did that mean to you?
That means that when the rumor was around they were going to trade me to Cleveland, Frank Lane was there, that I was so glad they didn't trade me. I did, and you might know that I did retire a little bit early. I was 29. Kubek was 29. The two of us said, hey, we've won 9 out of 10 years. That's starting in 55, where I was up for 20 days, and they voted me a third share of the World Series again the next year, and then 7 more pennants. And we said it's been 9 out of 10, but we're missing out on one thing in life, our priority with our kids. Both of us decided to retire. Sport Illustrated heard about it, came over, actually took the picture to have us on the cover of Sports Illustrated, $1 million infield. That was a lot of money in those days. Now it'd mean nothing. And then Ralph Houck came up and said, hey, I want one of you guys to play one more year and break Bobby Mercer in. It was all set that Tony would do that and I would retire. But as it turned out, he got called in the reserve program, got a pinched nerve. Mayo Clinic said he had to retire, might result in a permanent paralysis. So I went back, that did away with the Sports Illustrated thing, played one more year, and Bobby Mercer was drafted 2 weeks after I got there, so he wasn't even there for me to break him in, came back at the end of the season. But, as I look back, it was a great move for me. I was able to play at the right time with the right club and have just a wonderful, wonderful rapport with my teammates. I've been able to write a book and release a record and do a lot of things, but nothing compares to that rapport that we had with the Yankee Ball Club winning at that time.
You went on to be a baseball coach at South Carolina, took them to the NCAA tournament. You ran for Congress in the 5th Congressional District.
That's the one I'd like to forget.
Yeah.
The president asked me to run. President Ford was a friend of mine, and he asked me to run. And I was glad to do that, retired from after being finishing second of the nation and from the College World Series. Our record was 51-6, those last two losses going to Texas in the final two games. I had the Yankees and the Mets come down and play our ball club, and just a great time over there. But I got back in it a little bit later. I went down to Coastal Carolina, who just happened to win the championship in the college level this year. And I was the athletic director and baseball coach down there. And then finished up at Liberty University. They have a new stadium that's probably in the top 5 in the country. So the 3 schools I was associated with have a great baseball background.
For young people who are listening to Bobby Richardson, this is a guy who just didn't strike out. You didn't strike out. You were a contact guy. But what keeps jumping out at me is the 63 World Series in Sandy Koufax.
You got it.
Now, tell me about game one of the 63 series. Sandy,
sure will.
He got you 3 times. That's the only time in your career that anybody got you 3 times.
I sat by Sandy Koufax at Yogi's funeral. He said when I struck out the second time, I knew I had good stuff that day. And I remember so well, Kubek struck out, I struck out, and then Mantle struck out. Next time around, Kubek struck out, I struck out, Mantle struck out. Third time, I just wanted to be a first ball hitter and hit it somewhere. I didn't. Kubek struck out, I struck out. But I walked by Mantle, he shook his head, said it's no use for me to go up there. And he got him 3 times, too.
15 strikeouts in the game for Koufax. What? Try to give us an idea, because we can all watch it on film or... What's it like to sit in the box, stand in the box with Sandy Koufax on the hill?
Well, let me be honest now. Sandy had great stuff. He had wonderful control. His fastball came in and take off, but that same fastball with the same delivery was also his changeup. You could be way out in front. Curveball, drop it off a dime. Just a wonderful pitcher, and certainly rightly and one of the greats in the Hall of Fame. But now there was a 4th game. And if you look, he didn't pitch quite as well in the 4th game. In fact, I got 2 hits off of him in the 4th game. The thing I remember, we played a benefit game in Los Angeles at the old Coliseum for Roy Campanella. Joe Pignatano was catching. Kopex was on the mound. And I tried to bunt. And he said, I can't believe this. Left field is 250 feet here, and you're trying to bunt. I said, yeah, but look who's pitching.
Bobby Richardson, our guest, former Yankees second baseman. What was the appeal with politics to you?
Just the fact that I felt like I could contribute. I felt like I knew how to vote the right way for our country. And my intention was good. In fact, I've never done anything political after that except one thing. I headed up, we had the governor and a senator who were for John Conley when Ronald Reagan was running. And so General Mark Clark and I headed up South Carolina for Ronald Reagan, traveled all over the state with him. Boy, did he love baseball, and did the Cubs games. And that's the only thing I've ever done. As soon as he got the primary victory, we just dropped out. He did ask me to do one thing for him and followed up on that. He wanted me to speak at all of the military institutions around the world, Japan, Okinawa, Patrick Tinker, all of the various faces, which I was able to do on the day of prayer for the service people, and I've done that over the years.
You obviously love baseball because you come up at a young age, you play it, you're in that Yankees clubhouse, and you walk away at 30 years old, and then you go, you're back in baseball, in college baseball. Did you ever at any point look back and go, I left a little too early. Maybe I should have played two more, three more. Or were you just at peace walking when you did?
I was at peace because my boys were at that age where I came home and got active with them and watched them on the little league level, watched them go on up through. And by the time I coached college ball, my son was in college, came to play for me at the University of South Carolina. And I enjoyed college coaching as much as I did baseball. The one thing I remember, and this is just very funny, it won't take long to tell you, but it was the College World Series. Our record at that time was 3-0 out there. Arizona State was 2-1, and Texas was 2-1. For some reason, they put down three envelopes. I thought we should have gotten the bye, and I picked the wrong one. Texas got the bye. So we had to play Arizona. Eighth inning of the game, and Arizona was leading us 1-0, and we had two outs. My little leadoff hitter was up. And he had two strikes on him. He'd already struck out twice. I knew he was going to strike out. The pitcher knew he was going to strike him out, and everybody in the stands did too. He looked down at me with two strikes, two out, one runner on third base, third baseman playing well deep, and I gave the bunt sign to him. He laid a bunt down. Third baseman came running in, threw it over first base. He went to second, run scored, tie game. Next guy single. We beat him 2-1. And Robin Roberts and Brent Musburger were doing the game, and Brent said to Robin, surely Coach Richardson didn't put that butt on. He said, oh, no, he would never do a thing like that. And I enjoyed college coaching a lot.
Well, Bobby, I appreciate having you on the show. We'd love to have you back on another time. I think you also hit Bob Gibson 7-for-14, so I must know your secret there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but he knocked me down in an old Terminus game when I was 65 and hadn't played in 40 years.
Got you back.
Yes, it did.
Bobby Richardson, thank you, sir.
Enjoyed talking to you. Thanks.
Want more of the best of the Bald Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. The Bald Faced Truth with John Canzano. You're listening to the best of the Bald Faced Truth radio show.
Jerry Royce, 22 years in the big leagues, threw a perfect game that ended with Billy North hitting a comebacker to the mound.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Bill North had a little one or two hopper that rolled out in front of the plate, had all the time in the world to pick it up and make a throw. And after that, for the next 30 seconds, I don't remember a whole lot, except that I was a happy man.
And, you say you had all the time in the world, but I think there are a lot of guys that don't get down off the mound that aren't as good an athlete as you were, as good a fielder as you were off the mound, especially at 6'5".
Well, it was a routine ground ball, little tap back to the mound. It's something that, I can't tell you how many times I practiced it in spring training, but before that, practice it in high school, American Legion. Well, it was a routine play, and boy, was I glad to get it.
Jerry Royce with us. The bullpen before the game, we had Garvey on a couple weeks ago. I asked him about the no-hitter. He said that he remembers you saying you didn't think you had your great stuff in the bullpen, that you were kind of all over the place. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say I was all over the place, but I wouldn't consider when I warmed up that I had what most people would consider no-hitter stuff. It was routine. I didn't feel as if I were popping the ball as well as I had previously. But, you know, I've won ball games on less. And a lot of times when you get out there, suddenly it changes from warming up in the bullpen to getting between the white lines with competition at stake. So then it was just a matter of putting the ball where I wanted.
More fun when you have good stuff or when you have to work really hard and be creative to get guys out?
You know, it doesn't matter because a lot of times the choice isn't mine. It just happens. There were times when I warmed up and I told the pitching coach, I remember telling Ron Paranowski this one time, better keep somebody loose here because I just don't feel anything. And then I got to the ninth inning with a shutout. There were other times that I was so strong coming out of the bullpen, I said, somebody's going to pay for this because this is feeling pretty good. And the next thing I know, by the second or third inning, I'm wondering what happened.
When you see baseball today and you see guys pitch, who is it that you really appreciate, you know, their skill level or maybe how they get guys out?
You know, I don't watch that many games because they're broadcast a lot of games here in Las Vegas. And, well, after watching so many games as a player and as a broadcaster, I don't make it part of my nightly viewing menu. But there are a few guys out there that if I see that it's promoed and they're scheduled to pitch, you know, I'll take a few minutes to sit back and watch what's going on. First that comes to mind is Clayton Kershaw.
Jerry Royce is with us, two-time All-Star, former 22-year Major League veteran pitcher with the Dodgers. Las Vegas is interesting because you're going to get an NHL team in Vegas. How about other sports coming to Vegas? Is that city ready?
You know, I'm not sure. Somebody thinks they are. I really don't see it. The NHL, I don't know much about hockey, so I can't speak with any authority on that. I do know that they have a new stadium, and I know that there's some money behind it, so it may work. I don't know the economics of this sport. The one that really confuses me is the NFL. I don't know how the Raiders are going to make any money here because they don't have really a local TV base that pays like any of the other cities, with maybe the exception of Green Bay, but Green Bay also has Milwaukee close by. So, you know, it is an area that draws from a broad expanse of a radius. But here in Las Vegas, you got to go a couple hundred miles to get a neighboring area that also could support your ball club. Everything's pretty much centered in here, and it's less than 2 million people. So I don't know how the economics work because it's not a big TV market. It's not a big radio market. So if they're going to draw a lot of people, maybe that's what they're counting on. I haven't had a chance to see the numbers, and to be honest with you, John, if I saw them, I might not know what I'm looking at.
We're talking to Jerry Royce, veteran pitcher, big league pitcher, World Series champion in 1981. I'm always fascinated by the matchups, hitter versus pitcher. And I look at a guy like Pete Rose, who had more plate appearances against you than any other hitter. You turned Pete Rose, who arguably one of the greatest hitters in the history of baseball, you turned him into a very ordinary hitter. He hit only 250 against you. Why do you think you had success against Pete?
Well, because you kept hitting it at somebody. Pete was an excellent hitter. He just wasn't a real smart hitter when he faced me because he hit it hard right at somebody. Right. I can never remember an easy or a routine out with Pete Rose at the plate. So I was just fortunate, and it lasted for well over 100 or so plate appearances.
Yeah.
But if you go down the list and you take a look at some of the guys who hit pretty well against me, that to me is just as much a mystery as Pete not hitting 320 against me.
Mike Schmidt hit 411 against you with 11 home runs. When Schmidt got up there towards the end, when you realized this guy, for whatever reason, hits me well, do you change your approach with a guy? Are you overthinking at that point?
You know, I thought about it every which way possible, and I can summarize it in two words. Schmidt happens.
We're talking to Jerry Royce. Jerry, what's it like to win a World Series? 1981, you win it all.
You know, that was an interesting question because I've had a lot of people ask me that, and I really don't know how to give an answer to it because I don't know what the level of experience that the person who's asking the question has had. You know, recently I was inducted into the Missouri State Sports Hall of Fame, and there were maybe 18 to 20 other people that were going to be honored as I was on that particular evening earlier this year. And when everybody was introduced early in the day to each other so that we had an idea of who everybody was and what they did, there was a Super Bowl winner. There was an Olympic gold medal winner. There were college coaches that got to the NCAA finals. There were people across the board who have experienced success in their field. And I just wondered if they could answer that question, that very question, what's it like to win a World Series? Well, what's it like to win the NCAA or to play in a Super Bowl? All of those different things. And I realized at that point I had somebody that was right around me that could understand exactly what that was like. The best I can put it so that people could understand it is imagine having a dream as a kid and living that dream in your mind any number of times while growing up. And as you're growing up, you're getting better. You're separating yourself from the pack of everybody in your neighborhood, in your city, or even in your county or area where you live. You're separating yourself from the pack, and you know that you're ready to go on to bigger and better things, and it's just a question of how far you'll go. Making it to the major leagues it was something that was huge. It was better than one in a million. And staying there, well, the odds are even greater for that. But then imagine that actually pitching a no-hitter, playing in a couple of All-Star games, and then playing in and winning a World Series game. You have to take a look at odds. I can't put a number on those odds, but I do know this. I was blessed with the talent to be able to throw a fastball at 95 miles an hour and to make it move any number of different ways and to do it for 22 years. Now, I couldn't have done it on my own. I took some help to do that. There was somebody every step along the way that gave me some guidance, some advice. And as a result, I was able to play and perform to the level that I did for as long as I did.
You played in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. You're kind of an aberration in that you threw a lot of complete games. And I look at some years where you had 15 complete games or 14 or 11 or 12. And for comparison, Jake Arrieta wins the Cy Young last year. He threw four. Did you at any point in that 22 years say or realize that baseball is moving in a direction where the complete game wasn't going to be a benchmark of a starter anymore because they were going to try to preserve guys?
You know, John, as I got into my career a bit and I could see how different managers, I played for 15 different managers, how they like to operate, you know, I understood that a complete game wasn't as important as a win. And you're there to win ball games, and you have to win them the best way you know how. Now, for me, as a pitcher, my job was to get outs and to get outs from 1 to 27, and that was a complete game. You know, even in the years that I had a large number of complete games, when compared to what pitchers were doing 10 years previous, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
Because it was just a sign of the times. But as time went on and managers saw that if you can get six innings out of your starter and then have the matchups that you'd like to have, your relievers versus the opposition's bench, that became the way to manage a ballgame. And I think Tony La Russa might have been, well, the first to really do it with the kind of his success that he did. And there were others that did it well. Guys like Chuck Tanner I thought was pretty good. Sparky Anderson liked to mix and match him as well as anybody. Whitey Herzog had the game already played before the lineups were exchanged. So there were a lot of managers who were thinking at that particular level, but it was Tony La Russa that I think made the game into the game that we actually see today, and he did that 25 to 30 years ago.
You had a lot of at-bats. You hit one major league home run off Nino Espinoza. What do you remember about that at-bat?
It was to left field, and that's something unusual for a left-handed batter. I just hit it up in the air, and it didn't curve foul. Normally a ball like that peels down toward the line and then goes foul, but that kept carrying and it stayed fair. It hit the top of the fence in Veterans Stadium into the foul netting and fell right into the hands of the bullpen. So it was about as close to a home run or about as close as you can get and get one. It wasn't certainly a tape measure thing. In fact, it was 330 down the line. This was probably 330 and one inch.
You know, but you went opposite field. You get back to the dugout, what are guys saying to you?
They just kind of looked at me. And I don't even remember if they even stayed on the bench. A lot of them just probably went up. And, of course, I got the hazing that anybody else would for hitting their first home run. I don't remember anything about that after that. I just remember, make sure you don't trip going around the bases. Go 90 feet, touch the thing that looks like a house, and keep going until you get back to home plate.
Jerry Royce is our guest. What was it like to play for Tommy Lasorda? What was he like?
Well, I've been asked that question so many times. Every manager was different. Every manager that I played for in the major leagues had an idea about how to run a ball game. It may or may not have been successful for a lot of reasons. One, you've got guys who are injured. You may not have the players that you need to take you from being just an average run-of-the-mill team to the world championship. And the organization or the club may not have the funds to finance such a team to get you the top players. Tommy was fortunate to be managing the Dodgers at a time and a place when the Dodgers, if they needed a free agent, they could get one. And if they wanted to sign a ball player to a long-term contract, they could do so without the financial restraints that you saw in a lot of other ball clubs. And he probably had a say-so in putting his club together. So when you have those things going for you, then it makes things just a bit easier for you. But then Tommy had the personality. It still doesn't make a winner when you have the players. You got to find a way to get the best and the most out of a player that you possibly can. Tommy's way was unique, just like every other manager, and it was his way, uniquely his. So for him, it worked because in the 8 years that I was there, we got to the postseason four times. We narrowly missed going a fifth time, and then there were 3 years, but because of injuries, that we just couldn't make the postseason at all. So five times in the 8 years that I was there, and if you take a look at his record from the time he started in 77 all the way through the time he retired, you'll find out that for most part the Dodgers were in the hunt. Plus, he promoted the game as well or better than anybody else, probably since Casey Stengel. So you put all those things together, you got a winner, you got a guy who loved the game, promoted the game. There's no question as to why he's in the Hall of Fame, is there?
Fernando Valenzuela was so interesting to me because I was a Giants fan, and you guys just destroyed the Giants in that era with great pitching and great players, and you had this infield that was just formidable. Valenzuela as a teammate, given that you're both pitchers, there's a language barrier there. How closely can you relate? What was he like as a teammate?
He was quiet. He was in the background except when he was on the field. And when he pitched, on the night that he pitched, we had more media members. We had more reporters. The clubhouse was overrun with media members. And it was the first time that I could remember that any player got a press conference before he got into the city. And then after he pitched, they found a place for him to take care of the press after the ball game so that the clubhouse wouldn't be overcrowded. It was a phenomenon. Make no mistake about it. And with Fernando at 20 years old, nobody had seen anything like it. And I imagine throughout the careers of everybody that was there, they never saw anything like it after that. So it was a unique experience. They called it Fernando Mania. And I think in the long term, probably he brought more people, Spanish-speaking people, interested now in Major League Baseball than ever before. And they're still fans, all as the result of following Fernando Valenzuela.
Yeah, and I think you've watched the Dodgers, and I felt like when Yasiel Puig came in, they were trying to kind of recreate that cultural phenomenon. And Ichiro had that in Seattle as well. You know, Ichiro comes around, suddenly there's this Japanese contingent of media and people around the teams, and Yao Ming with China in being with the Houston Rockets. I just always wondered as teammates, like, you know, when you see that happening, it can't be something that you plan for, or can't be something that's expected. If, you know, your career, as you went around different places, and obviously, you know, you finish your career in St. Louis you finish your career with Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, and Chicago, you got a chance to see other places. Did it give you an appreciation for being with the Dodgers for so long?
You know, every place I played, it was unique. I played for 8 different teams, the Pirates twice. And you might as well count them as a different team because there wasn't anybody there from the second time that was there the first time other than me. So it was different managers, different players, and a different outlook by the city. and it was just a different time and place. Now, as far as appreciating what I had in Los Angeles, I always appreciated that, because in the years that I was there, in my opinion, it was as good as it could possibly get. We played in what I thought was the best park in the National League. And after I took a tour around the American League, I said, you know, Dodger Stadium is still pretty good, and it stacks up well against anything that the American League had to offer. But then again, I retired in 1990, so I haven't seen many of the new ballparks, even though I broadcast 3 years on the radio for the Dodgers. So it's different seeing it than it is playing in the ballpark and experiencing the ups and downs of being a player. You know, playing for the Dodgers, it was special because we were ready to fly. And it was a special time. The plane, the way they treated families, playing at Dodger Stadium, it was as good as it got.
Jerry, I really appreciate you making time for us. I know you're busy, and congratulations yesterday on the anniversary of that no-hitter, and appreciate you making time.
No, John, it was fun talking about it. You know, I really don't think that much about the no-hitter on a daily basis. Now, it may come into mind as a fleeting thought or in reference to something else, but I never get into the depth of it, discussing it, other than a couple of years ago when I wrote about it in my book, Bringing the Right-Hander. And because people ask a lot of questions about pitching a no-hitter, it begins with, were you disappointed that you didn't have a perfect game, or what was it like to pitch a no-hitter?
I blame Garvey for that. He should have caught that ball in the first inning.
Well, you know, nobody knew that there was going to be a no-hitter.
Come on, Garvey.
Who would have guessed? Well, it was a throw that was in the dirt, and I'll tell you, I would say 9 times out of 10, Garv gets that ball easily, but this one hit the heel of the glove. It was an error. These things happen. So
he blames the he said the grounds crew watered it down at Candlestick, and I was like, no, you were out there before the game. You took ground balls. Come on.
Yeah, I was asked at the end of the game, was I disappointed that I didn't get a perfect game? How could you be disappointed when you pitch a no-hitter? You know, a perfect game is a perfect game, and there's only been a few that have been pitched. What is it, 13 or 14? You know, I'm not really sure about the number. But Leonard Coppett, who wrote for the San Francisco Bay Area papers so many times over the years, probably put it best in proper perspective when he came up to me and he says, you know, what you did was better than a perfect game. And I said, Leonard, how do you figure that? He said, because you had to get 28 outs. You only need 27 for a perfect game. And I said, Leonard, I'm going to run with that. Thank you.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
There's a long drive to deep left. That ball going. And it is caught by Rooney. Joe Rooney robs him of extra bases against the wall, and they nearly double up Perez at first. What a grab by Joe Rooney.
Joe Rooney, three-time All-Star, three-time World Series champion, Gold Glove winner. Currently, I think he lives in Baker City. Getting him on the show here. How are you, sir?
Hey, doing great, John. How are you today?
Are you in Baker City?
Yeah, we're back here now. We retired here 3 or 4 years ago, and we sort of snowbird, go down south in the winter time. It gets a little chilly over here, and then come back here around late May, early June, whenever it gets warm here.
I know you were born in Central California, and what brought you, like, where was the first time you said, you know, I'm going to Baker City? That's where I will spend part of the year.
Well, actually, Harmon Killebrew was a good friend, and Gene Tennis and I used to hunt a lot there in the Bay Area. We used to go out to Sacramento a lot on the flyway. They went to hunt ducks and quail and pheasants and all that stuff. And we used to talk hunting with Herman all the time. He grew up here in Ontario, Oregon, which is about halfway between Baker and Boise, Idaho, about 75 miles from here. And he kept inviting us to come up hunting. And so finally, I think it was after the 73 World Series, we came up and spent 2 weeks with him here and went hunting and just had a ball and fell in love with the area. Reminded me a lot of the area I grew up in, Central California, a little area called Oakdale Waterford area there, country I grew up in, what was left of my grandparents' dairy, and this is sort of a rural area. We had four kids, and it was just a perfect spot to be able to take the kids. We bought a little ranch about 10, 12 miles out of town, and we just love living here. We've been here since about 70, the winter of 76, 77, when I left the A's to go to the Angels, when I came up and bought the ranch.
The people who hunt, they really hunt. I mean, they get into it. And I've been into the stores that have the hunting and equipment, and those guys are like into the every element of it. What is it about hunting that draws you in?
I think it was a challenge. I guess it started chucker hunting with Harmon, and it's such a challenge. It's such tough terrain, very steep, but mostly in the breaks of the Snake River down here. And very, very tough. And, of course, I loved working with dogs. Had some great short years. And just watching them, chuggers were great to eat. I never hunted anything that I didn't eat. It wasn't too much into the big game stuff. I like to watch the deer and elk too much. But the birds that we enjoyed eating, pheasants and quail and the chuckers were great. So it was just a challenge. It was just, you know, like anything else. We were back then in good shape and could handle walking up down those steep hills. And it was a lot of fun. I haven't hunted now apart for 20 years. I lost my last short here. They're about 98. And just haven't picked up a gun since.
What makes a good hunting dog?
Well, depending on what you're trying to hunt, like we're down in the Bay Area there around Sacramento at labs, Labradors.
That, yeah.
They're great retrievers. And then when you get up here, they're a little bit heavier boned. And so you go to the German Shorthairs, which were, pointing dogs that would hold. You didn't want a flushing dog. And so, dogs that followed your commands and all that stuff and wouldn't run too far out in front of you and flush the birds before you got to them. So did a lot of training, but, when you had a good dog, boy, they were worth the weight in gold.
Joe Rudy, our guest, three-time World Series champion. I grew up in the Bay Area. I am familiar with the A's World Series runs. And only until I was later did I understand that, it wasn't all peaches with ownership and players, but you had such a magical group of players. Why was it that those A's teams were so dominant?
Well, I think, when Philly bought the A's and started going there, he had a great scouting department. And, the early 60s, almost all of us signed and played in the minor. Back then, you stayed with one club for quite a while. So a lot of us played together for 10, 12, 13 years. And so we grew up together, signed when we were 17, 18 years old, and went through A-ball and double-A. Philly sort of threw us out there pretty early and let us play. We started having struggles. He sent us down for a couple of weeks, got our swing back, and then, going like that. So it was a lot of fun, and like I said, we had a great bunch of guys. I wish we'd have a little bit better. Philly would have understood things a little better. I mean, we had a great farm system. I think we could have kept winning. You got to be lucky to win the World Series, but we would have a really good ball club for another 5, 7, 8 years, I think, because most of us at the time on that crew were just in our late 20s, 27, 28, and 74, and we had a bunch of really good young players coming up.
The ownership, how tough was it when you had an owner that was trying to sell players, amid all that winning?
Well, I don't blame Charlie. I really don't. I mean, he didn't want to get involved in the free agency bidding. Oakland, was a small market. We were doing great there, even in the years that we had good teams. Drawing a million people most of the time was still because of half price, nights they would have almost every Monday when we were home, and just did not draw that well. So we were not a large income team. And in 76, it was tough, but, free agency came along. He didn't want to get involved in that. And, he sold myself and fingers to the Red Sox and bite it to the Yankees, you know, I thought he had every right to do it. Unfortunately, you know, Bowie Kuhn overturned that sale and, you know, really cost Charlie about $3.5 million.
Raleigh Fingers, Reggie Jackson, the personalities on those A's teams that won championships. What was the clubhouse like?
Oh, well, the clubhouse was great. I mean, we really did get along great. But, you know, we had our little fights and disagreements and stuff. But when you put, you know, 30 guys together that closely for almost 8 months, seven, 8 months, and, you know, egos involved in playing at that level, and we had a great bunch of guys. We really got along great. You know, it's just like, you know, having five or six brothers in one family. You're going to have some disagreements. And, you know, we still get along with each other well when we see each other. We have reunions and stuff from time to time. And so we had a great bunch of guys. Really good.
Joe Rudy is our guest. Do you watch baseball today? Are you in tune with what's going on?
Yeah, no, I watch, you know, couple games a week. I, you know, try to follow the Mariners up here now, and of course the A's. Anytime I can get them on TV, so it's been fun doing that. But I don't watch it as closely as I did. You know, we travel quite a bit. We live about half the year in a motorhome, and so we're traveling a lot of places. You know, we're not getting the TV or internet to follow things, but whenever possible, I try to follow the game.
What do you see and what do you draw from baseball today versus maybe baseball of your era?
Well, I think the players are, I mean, you know, I think back now when I was, you know, we're talking about 40 years ago that we were in the World Series years. And I think back to when I was playing in 1973, 40 years would have been the 1930s. And I know what I thought about the guys that came up in the 40s and 50s, you know, that they were ancient fossils. So, and you know, we heard the same stuff then as we hear today, where the players are, you know, they're not into the game as much. They're all in it for money, you know, all the different things. But I think every generation that the athletes have gotten better. We've done more and more with conditioning and strength, proper weightlifting type techniques and all this stuff. So the kids today are far better. I don't think they're, you know, just the basic training has improved so much. When I first signed, we would have got fined if we had showed up in spring training. It looked like we had been lifting weights all year. I didn't really start getting into the weights until my late 20s.
Yeah.
And it's just a different world.
Did you, because before that, you know, was the theory that you didn't want to be bulky as a player, as an athlete?
Well, back at that time, you know, every time anybody talked about weights, they thought of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger or somebody of that, you know, type where you couldn't even get your arms above your shoulders. And so, as I said, that, you know, they've learned over the years here in the last 40 years the proper weightlifting, what kind of weights to lift, what to stay away from, and all that stuff. And so the guys are so much stronger now than we were. And, you know, it's just overall in one part of it, I think it has hurt some of the guys because today, when, you know, you get injuries, guys are, you know, tearing tendons off a bone and more serious injuries. Our most serious thing was, you know, maybe getting hit in the breaking a bone or something or pulling a hamstring and being out for a few weeks. Now guys, you know, get hurt and they're out the rest of the season. So, you know, with all the strength does come problems.
Game 5 of the World Series where you hit the home run off Mike Marshall. It ends up being the, you know, the clincher for the series in 1974, Game 5 of that series. Take us through that at bat. Were you sitting on a pitch in a location? Were you just see ball, hit ball? What were you thinking?
Well, you know, Mike Marshall was a great pitcher, and he had a tremendous changeup. And you know, almost like a screwball changeup, and that was his out pitch. And, you know, that whole time when people started throwing stuff at Buckner after he got thrown out of third, it took, you know, probably 15 minutes between the time that Marshall warmed up and then, you know, he walked out towards left field, and, you know, he never threw a warm-up pitch. And so I'm watching him, and, you know, the umpire tells him, go ahead and, you know, throw a few pitches to warm, and he goes, waved him off, and said, no, I'm ready. And so I said to myself, anyway, I said, well, this guy's got to throw a fastball. I said, I can't throw a first pitch screwball and hurt his arm. And so, you know, I was sitting on the fastball, and he threw an inside fastball to me. And, you know, fortunately, I turned on it and hit it pretty good for the home run. But it was just one of those odd circumstances that, you know, happens every once in a while. And, you know, I guessed right.
Did you approach most at-bats like that, or was that a rare case where you thought, I'm pretty sure I know what this guy is going to do. I'm looking for it.
Well, I think, you have to watch the pitcher. I mean, that's part of the game. I mean, you're watching his tendencies. You know, a lot of times we had, especially when we got toward the playoff times, we would have the scouts that were following the teams we were going to play, and they would come in with a scouting report and say, you know, in certain circumstances, this is what this guy has a tendency to throw. You never know for 100%, but and then the same thing. You're watching how he's pitching other right-handed hitters, and, you know, is he just laying the ball in there on the first pitch to get a strike, and, you know, on and on. But you really do try to pay attention to what he's throwing, what is he getting over. You know, is he getting his curveball over, or is he missing with it mostly and only throwing, you know, fastballs for strikes? You're just paying attention to what's happening on the field. And so a lot of times you're going to sit on a pitch and what, you know, what the pitcher has done to you in the past, how he's tried to get you out. You know, we keep notes on every pitcher.
Joe Rudy is our guest, former Major League All-Star. That first All-Star game that you play in July of 1972, it's in Atlanta. You walk into that clubhouse for All-Star game, and you, of course, have teammate like Reggie Jackson in there, and you've got Yastrzemski and Dick Allen and Brooks Robinson and Jim Palmer and Luis Aparicio. And you look around there. What'd you think when you look around the clubhouse and you look across and see Joe Morgan and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Willie Stargell on the other side?
Well, obviously, as a young player, the hardest thing to get over is the feeling that you belong. I mean, most sports or, you know, different types of things you get into as a young player, you know, can I play with these guys? Do I really belong here? And, of course, you know, going to my first All-Star game, my eyes were wide open and looking at all these superstars that I had watched in high school. I'm just 24, 25. I can't even remember how old I was in that first All-Star game. And, so it was, you know, just a huge honor to even be there. And it was, you know, watching all these people that you had watched as a high school player and even playing in the minor leagues, you know, these were your idols. And it was just a great thrill for me to even be there.
By a few years later, you are a starter in left field in an All-Star game, and you'd been to a couple. Did you ever have a young player walk up to you and be like, Joe, I watched you when I was coming up, and switch roles in that way?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate to get to the big leagues at a pretty young age. And so, you know, I had some time in by the time I was 30. You know, I had almost 10 years in the big leagues. And so it was a real blessing, like I said, to come up with the A's. It's one of the reasons I signed with the A's. Yeah, signed me. You know, they don't really have much in the big leagues, and they're, you know, Philly's really trying to sign a lot of young players. And, you know, I went from A-ball in the California League. I was starting left fielder in Kansas City in 1967, and I fielded 19 or 20 at that time, 20. And so it was, you know, it was a big thrill. And, you know, we went up down, Reggie and myself, and a lot of the guys were going up and down. And it was just, Finley just had a knack for bringing the guys up and down and knowing when to get them going. And it was, you know, 1970 was my first really full chance that I had to play regularly. I was missing a lot of games. Back then we still had the draft, and I got my draft notice my first year. So I ended up, the ball club put me in the Marine Corps Reserves. And, of course, you can't, back then, because of the Vietnam War, you couldn't miss a drill or a weekend or a summer camp or you'd get activated. And so, you know, those days used to cost me probably anywhere from 30 to 40, maybe 50 games a year, being gone for drill weekends. Because a lot of times you were back east, you'd have to fly home on a Thursday because you had to be there at 5 o'clock Friday and you weren't released till 5 o'clock on Sunday. And then come back on Thursday, you leave on Monday to rejoin the club. So you're going to miss four or five games at least almost every drill weekend. It was a lot better than being gone for 2 years, which at that point in time. But, you know, we're just very, very fortunate with the guys coming up. You know, went down to the Angels and in 1977 and had a lot of young players there. And, you know, same thing, Carney Lansford, like my little brother, he's 10 years younger than I am, and he was a first-year player. They used to put guys together with older players back in the room together, and so that's how I met Carney. We became very good friends. He lives here in Baker also part of the year. And anyway, it was a really great time. Like I said, we had a great bunch of guys, and that's the thing that I miss the most of being out of the game is not being around those people.
You know, I look at, you know, when we had Jerry Royce on the show yesterday, and I was looking at his record against, you know, certain hitters. What did they hit off him? And I always look at that stuff. Just I'm fascinated by matchups. And I look at the number of guys that you hit, you know, 500 or above against. And there's a huge list of guys that, you know, some of it was 1 for 2, but some of it was, you know, you were 7 for 13 off Jim Wright, you know, historically. And Bill Stoneman, you hit him. You're 4 for 5 off him. And I think you got a hit off him in that All-Star game. Did you hit the double off Stoneman or Tug McGraw?
I think I hit off Tug McGraw my very first game there in Atlanta.
And I look at the guys that, you know, was there a pitcher, like if I give you an at-bat in a time machine, is there a guy that you'd love to see that you, for whatever reason, you hit well, or maybe a guy that you'd hate to see because you just didn't hit well for whatever reason?
Well, it's hard to say because every day, you know, some days you're hot and you're not. You know, most left-handers I love facing. Jim Palmer was always, you know, very tough. Pitcher to face, you know, he threw so high, you know, he was 6'5 to start with, and he threw with an extremely high delivery, you know, very hard to lay off a high fastball. That's why he's in the Hall of Fame. But yeah, there was always pitchers, but there was times when you know, they were pitching great. There was times when we were hotter and you know, a fritter, and didn't make any difference what they threw up there. It looked like a basketball coming at him.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Joe Rudy, and we wish you the best, and thank you for making time for us.
Very nice to talk to you. Yeah, it's been a beautiful day over here, and we're actually sitting out here on the 13th hole of the Baker City Golf Course, and hardly anybody out here, so it's been great. My wife and I play golf almost every day while we're home here, so it's just a beautiful day, and we love Oregon. Gorgeous place. Spent a lot of time over there in Portland, Hillsboro.
All right, Joe Rudy, you're the best. Thank you.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here. This is the BFT with John Canzano. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Ken Griffey Sr. joining us. How are you, sir?
All right, doing fine.
You miss being out there on fresh-cut grass ballpark afternoon game?
Right now, no, I don't miss it. Like I said, I enjoyed when I retired, I enjoyed the chance to get to watch Junior play, so I didn't miss it very much. Plus, I got the opportunity to watch a lot of young kids play and still within coaching and managing at that time.
Everybody knows about Junior's start with baseball and your influence. Who was it? Who was the person in your life that put the glove in your hands?
My older brother, James Jim Bell. Yeah, my game was football.
At what point did you know baseball was it for you?
Well, when I signed, I had no other choice. I didn't have a scholarship to play football or anything. So when I signed a baseball contract, I said, I'm going to have to make the best of it for me.
Your All-Star game, the first All-Star game you played in 1976 in Philadelphia. On the other, you know, you walk into the clubhouse and you've got, you know, some guys like Joe Morgan and Pete Rose and George Foster and some other guys like that. What did you think of that experience that first time?
Well, at the time, you know, George was down with me all year in AAA with Indianapolis, and he came up a little later.
Yeah.
But, you know, the biggest thing was, you know, getting the opportunity to play with Pete and Joe and Johnny, Tony Perez and David Concepcion was a big bonus for me. You know, so I had a good time doing that.
Were you starstruck by anybody at that time? Or, you know, you look across the way and you see Thurman Munson and Rod Carew over there? Or by that point of your career, had you sort of said, you know, I belong here?
No, I was never starstruck. You know, there was one person in my life that told me there was nobody better than me once I got between the white lines, and that was my mother. So I never got starstruck. Now, when I was younger, at 13, I got a chance to meet Willie Stargell. That was the biggest thing in my life, was getting a chance to meet Willie Stargell.
I love seeing Willie Stargell hit.
Oh, everybody did. I emulated Willie a lot.
He could. He when he hit home runs, they were not cheap.
No, they weren't.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to Willie about that and tell him, hey, man, I grew up and when I was a kid and, you know, you had that conversation?
Yeah, I had that conversation with him a couple of times, you know, especially in my first big league exhibition game. I got a chance to start him against the Pirates and Willie was playing first. So, yeah, I got a chance to really talk to him about certain things that went on and, you know, when I got a chance to meet him and everything else.
August the 25th, 1973, you make your major league debut. What do you remember about that day, that game?
Well, that game was a little, you know, it was exciting because of the fact I was getting my first start in the big leagues. And it was against Rick Wise. I think I had two hits that day. I was 2-for-5, I think it was, or 2-for-4. And it was just a great start to a, you know, a situation where I didn't think I'd ever get to the big league, but I made it and had two hits that day, and it was big for me.
Ken Griffey Sr. is our guest. Junior's Hall of Fame induction's coming up later this month. Baseball's been glue for your family, hasn't it?
Well, it has been. You know, I mean, that gave us an opportunity really to put, the, I guess, everything in perspective when, you know, getting a chance to play with Junior and getting a chance to watch Craig play. So, all that together, you know, it kind of put the glue where it needed to be in terms of gluing our family together in terms of baseball.
World Series champion 1975, 1976. You mentioned some of the players on those teams. How much fun was that to be part of teams that were so talented and so successful?
It was, you know, a lot of fun. Like I said, we all enjoyed playing with each other, playing baseball, period. We didn't make very many mistakes as a team, and we played hard every night, and we had a great time just playing the game of baseball.
You had Sparky Anderson as a manager. What made Sparky successful?
Well, he just let us go. You know, we went and played the game, and he just let us play.
And, you know, it's interesting because you win in 75, and you see some teams that win that don't get back. But in 76, you got back, and not only that, you sweep the Yankees. And Joe Morgan, I think, hits the home run in game one that kind of set things off. You know, what kept that team so focused after 75?
Well, it was just we were a little older. We were a little more experienced, a little more. We had that stride in our step. We knew we can play. You know, so we just enjoyed, and we knew we were going to come back and win it again the next year. So I think that was the biggest thing. We just got the opportunity to play, and we were a little more experienced. George Foster, myself, Davey Concepcion, Geronimo, and they had the old guys, the big four. So they were all, they were all impressive too, and they knew that we had a chance to win it for the second year.
Ken Griffey Sr. is our guest. Baseball today, are you locked in as a fan today? And, you know, do you find yourself appreciating the game the way that you did when your son was playing or maybe when you were playing? Or does it lose something when you don't have the family connection?
Well, not only that. I mean, I'm retired. I don't have the family connection anymore. So the only thing I get a chance to do is watch Billy Hamilton play a little bit. You know, being I've managed him with the Bakersfield Blaze for a year. And most of the pitchers, Tony Cingrani, those guys that I got a chance to manage down in the minor league. So that's the only connection I have with it.
Did you enjoy the managing part, or does it, when you're not playing, does it just, you know, you lose that adrenaline rush that you get as a player?
The managing part was fine. You know, I mean, I just enjoyed doing the managing and just watching kids getting a chance to help them play.
We've seen cases of players who grow or kids that grow up in clubhouses that grow up entitled. How did you manage to keep Junior's feet on the ground? Ken Griffey Sr. back with us. I'm fascinated by just that dynamic of you're a ball player, your son's in the clubhouse. You know, how do you raise a great person when everybody's going, this guy's going to be a great ball player, and they're just, you know, there's almost an entitlement that comes with it that is really challenging.
Well, first of all, you know, Junior was really never in the clubhouse as much. I mean, when we won games, they were allowed to come in after the game. And Junior, the only time Junior was not on the field, actually when he was father and son game, when we got a chance to play kids when they were younger.
Yeah.
But I owe a lot of that to his mom. She put a lot of pressure on him to make sure he cleaned up his room, make sure he did all his chores. His mother did a heck of a job there. You know, my situation, make sure he wanted to play. I wanted to make sure he was happy playing what he was playing.
I think you and your wife, you could write a book on parenting that, along with a couple other, like Marcus Mariota's parents, I think it would be a smashing success.
Well, we just have to sit down and do that one day.
I just think, like, yeah, I'm fascinated. Like, I want to know, did he have to make his bed? What happened when he got in trouble?
He had to, you know? He had to do all that. When he got in trouble, you know, the big thing about when he did get in trouble as he got older, you know, out in New York, he got a chance to come up and take batting practice. So I batting practice to him when he had in trouble. And since I got traded in New York and I lived in New York for the summer and he was still in school and then he started playing. So I started working with him up in New York, going batting practice. He understood how to field and all that kind of stuff up there.
Congratulations to you, not only on your career, but you and your wife, Valerie, on raising good kids. I think that's just as important.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
The winner of the 2014 Heisman Memorial Trophy is Marcus Mariota of the University of Oregon.
Marcus Mariota joining us. Do you ever hear the highlights? Do you get a chance to listen to them?
Every now and then. Usually when I'm doing, radio interviews like that, you kind of hear it over the the speaker. But anyways, thank you for having me. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. 9 of 10 on Saturday, 104 yards and a touchdown. You have not had a pass that has hit the ground yet. In the preseason.
Yeah, unfortunately, the incompletion was an interception.
Yeah, I was trying to spin that positive. That's just me. But
appreciate that.
Does that stick with you, an interception in the preseason, or do you just say, okay, mulligan there, let me watch film, see what I did wrong? Or what do you think about?
It sticks with you no matter what. Anytime you turn the football over, especially in that situation when you're driving, the team's moving, there's a little bit of momentum. It kind of sticks with you. But fortunately, like you said, it's preseason. You can learn from it. In that instance, I was trying to force the ball in a place I probably shouldn't have. I should have just taken what the defense was giving me and continue to move the chains.
Season has everybody kind of excited because you look like you've got more talent around you, running game, obviously, some places to go with the ball. As the roster kind of came together, were you excited to see who was coming in?
Definitely. John Robinson, our GM, and Coach Malarkey did a great job of, bringing in some new faces. A lot of times, these guys are vet guys that have played around the league for a long time. That can bring much more than just their physical abilities, but, also some leadership. And, we're very fortunate to have them, and we're excited as well.
Marcus Mariota, our guest, Titans quarterback. Year two versus year one, how different or less distracting, or is it less distracting because you're not coming out of a draft into a rookie season?
Just from a standpoint of confidence and just feeling more comfortable, I think year two has just been light years ahead of what it was last year. You go through everything that happened last season, you experience a lot of different things. Everything's kind of brand new, and then now you're coming into year two and you know what to expect. You're around a lot of familiar faces. You're in a similar setting as to how it was last season, and just feel a lot more comfortable. And, I can definitely say that I feel just a lot more comfortable and more excited as we move forward as a team.
How hard was it for you to, because you'd won games in high school and you won games in college. You didn't lose very often. You get to the NFL and you guys, even though you were playing well, you were more competitive, you weren't always getting the result. How hard was that for you?
It was tough, to be honest, and that's part of it. I'm very fortunate to be here in Nashville. I want to be a part of a team to, kind of rebuild and hopefully get it going in the right direction. We brought in a lot of good players this season. We've got a lot of guys that can make plays, and now it's just going out there and executing. And I'm excited to be a part of it, and very blessed to be here in Nashville.
the face mask is getting a lot of time, and I got to be honest, I looked at this face mask that everybody says has an 808 in it, and at first I didn't see it. I felt like I was looking at one of those pictures where there's supposed to be a sailboat in it, and then I was like, it's just a face mask. But yeah, there's an 808 in there. How important was that to you, or is that just something that you know is fun for fans to talk about?
Well, you know what, I was very blessed to have the opportunity to wear it in college. You know, I was able to wear it at Oregon for a couple of years, and unfortunately last season, you know, the NFL has a certain policy with customized face masks, and I wasn't able to wear it last season, but now they cleared it and everything's good to go, so, you know, I have an opportunity to wear it this season. But it's more of a way to pay homage to where I come from. It's an easy reminder for me of, you know, where I've been and where I've come from, and just never forget that and continue to hopefully represent all that in a good way.
It's still to this day, I meet somebody, I was in an elevator the other day, and there was a couple in the elevator, and they're from Hawaii, and I told them I was from Oregon, and they were like, oh, Marcus Mariota. I mean, there's just that association that is like glue. Do you get that? Like, anytime you see a Hawaiian, is there just a recognition?
Of course. You know, it's very easy to relate something like Hawaii, and it's an easy icebreaker. You can talk for hours. A lot of times, you know, you meet someone from Hawaii, you know, either a family friend or, you know, you might be related some way or another, because it's such a small island. So whenever you have an opportunity to meet somebody that's local and from Hawaii, I try my best to do it you know, just talk for a little bit.
What are you better at, say, now than maybe a year ago? Where have you improved?
I think, one, understanding in terms of defenses and coverages and how to handle certain situations, whether it's the run game or protections. You know, last season, a lot of it was new. Playing at Oregon, you know, we faced a lot of tough defenses, but at the same time, you don't face a lot of the complexities that you do here in the league, just based purely on the fact of how fast we played at Oregon, and a lot of teams have to kind of simplify what they do, just because they don't want to get caught off guard with the tempo that we played at. So I think from that standpoint, I learned a lot. You know, I learned that it is a business, and it's a business of merit. If you're not doing what is expected of you, unfortunately, you know, it might be your time to leave. But all in all, you know, a lot of that experience that I was able to gain from last season has really prepared me for this year, and I'm excited to use my knowledge and just do my best out on the field.
Marcus Mariota, our guest, you have to be really careful with your time, and I know you get pulled in a million directions with interviews and fan requests, and you know, I often saw you signed autographs after you guys lost that Arizona game. And I mean, I looked at you and I was like, that says so much about you. But how do you protect Marcus Mariota, the athlete who needs to have that time to prepare for your job while you're being pulled in a million directions? Where do you draw those lines?
Well, I'm a part of a team, you know, here with the Tennessee Titans that, you know, they do a great job of kind of segmenting my time, making sure I'm doing what they feel is a priority in terms of interviews, or you know, maybe there's charity events here and there that you know, I can be a part of. And then from there, secondly, I have a group, you know, within my family and with my agent and some of the marketing people that I work with that also take the time to kind of develop, you know, course of action for things during a week. And you know, with those two groups, they make my life really easy. You know, I'm very fortunate to have them. They, you know, they set everything up. You know, a lot of times, you know, I just have to kind of be there and they kind of give me all the information that I need to, be the best that I can be in that situation. So, I'm very blessed to have people in my corner that really help me out.
Your parents, I know they'd talked about, seeing games this season. They had also talked about your brother, Matt, and staying close to Oregon. How is Matt doing, and your parents, are they getting out regularly? Did they get out regularly for games last year?
They, first of all, Matt's doing great. He's loving it up there. Sounds like he's playing pretty well. It sounded like he had a pretty good scrimmage the other day. So I'm excited for him. I know they roll out their game in a couple of weeks. So, hopefully I'll be able to catch that out here on the Pac-12 network. My parents, they try to come as much as they can. They're going to do their best to, split time between my brother and I. And, it's all a blessing to even have them around. And I'm always looking forward to them whenever they have an opportunity to make it out here.
You guys at the running back position got better, and you got some talent back there. When you look into that backfield and see the guys that you have, what gets you excited?
Well, you got someone like DeMarco Murray, who's kind of a home run threat every time he touches the football. And then you turn around, and then there's Derrick Henry, who won the Heisman last season, and can really ground and pound it between the tackles and make our make our offense that much more versatile. So I'm excited to have what we have. I think they're going to make a lot of people's jobs easier. They do a great job in protections as well. They're very knowledgeable, and we're excited just to even have them around.
I look too at the receivers, and I look at last year, and I don't know what you would have done without Delanie Walker, because it seemed to be a good connection for you and somewhere to go with the ball. But you've got more places to go with the ball this year, and guys that can hurt the defense even with a short pass. How do you feel about these guys, and how much different does that feel to you?
I have incredible confidence with these guys. You're bringing someone like Andre Johnson, who has been an elite receiver for a long time, has really kind of cemented himself, hopefully for one day being in the Hall of Fame. And then you got a lot of young guys like Tajay Sharp and Rashard Matthews. And, you kind of combine that group, and, they have an outstanding leader in both Andre and Harry. And then you got some guys that can really make some plays and, basically fly. And, we're excited to have them. They've made countless plays through this preseason, through training camp. And, we're going to kind of hold them to that standard, and it's going to be the expectation for them.
All right, I'm going to cut you loose. Before I do, one of the questions I always get asked is, I always asked about your upbringing and your parents, because people want to take parenting advice from your parents. Did you have to make your bed as a kid?
I did. My parents really wanted me to do that and develop a good habit. But Coach Rad at the University of Oregon talked about how Nelson Mandela used to make his bed every single day. And someone of his stature felt that it was important to prepare your day that way, because you started off with a good habit. And, along with my parents' teachings and really just kind of solidifying that with Coach Rad, it's kind of stuck with me ever since, and I do it every single day.
Marcus, good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The Bald-Faced Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Drew Bledsoe, he's got four kids. State champion at Summit High School, and his son John is just committed to Northern Arizona University. And Drew Bledsoe is joining us now. What's that feel like now to watch your kids go through what you went through once upon a time?
It's a little surreal. There are a lot of similarities, and then there's some pretty dramatic differences too. But my older son's heading off to Cal Poly down in San Luis Obispo to go play lacrosse and study wine business down there next year, and then John's going to head to Northern Arizona the year after this. So my college trips are going to be pretty good, man, to go visit the kids. I'm going to San Luis Obispo, and then I'm going to Flagstaff. Two pretty good towns, so it's nice to have an excuse to go see the boys down there.
Not only that, you got somebody in the family who's interested in the wine business.
Absolutely. It's good. If he works hard, gets really good at it, maybe I'll let him work for the family business one of these days.
I was out at a winery this last week. I had family in town, and we went out to Oswego Hills Winery, and it's a family-run place. You could see, like, generations, and the kids are all working there and stuff. And I thought, how much fun is that to have a business that everybody's into like that, that there's a passion in the family for it?
You know, it is, and it remains to be seen. You know, we're certainly not going to force our kids into the family biz, and that's not the intention. But you know, if you or one of the other kids or a few of the other kids decide that they want to work in the family biz, you know, that'd be a pretty cool thing.
The you know, the decision that you made to kind of be involved in your kids' football careers and high school careers and be around it, why was that important to you?
You know, my original intention was to just be dad and sit in the stands. That was what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't want to, I didn't want to jump in and be involved and having a name that people know, you know, I wanted to stay out of it. But what became apparent to me, you know, watching, was that I had a body of knowledge that I could help. And not only my kids, but you know, all their buddies that were playing ball. And I also determined that I was not going to be very good at sitting in the stands and watching it.
Yeah.
It was being done properly. My wife actually pushed me into it. She goes, look, I can't sit next to you during games and if it's not going well. So you got to either get involved or you can't come to the game. So I decided I'd get involved. And you know, my dad was a high school football coach for 30-plus years. And after doing it for 3 years, I 100% get it. It's been the most rewarding thing that I've ever done. And having a chance to be around these young men as they're transitioning from boyhood to manhood and to be able to have some impact on their lives that's bigger than sport, it's a great privilege and something that I've really enjoyed. And my commitment was that I would do it through my son Henry's graduation. He's going to be a sophomore, so my $0 6-year contract is up at that point, and I'll have to make a decision whether I'm going to re-up and coach some more.
Because you have a problem like sitting in the stands, because not only are you tortured, but anything you say, you know, is going to get back to the coach and the offensive coordinator. They're looking over their shoulder. They're going, are we making Drew happy in the stands? So you might as well be down there coaching.
Yeah, I think that was part of it too, John. You know, and I knew that you know, other parents were looking to me to see if it was okay to be unhappy with something or, you
yeah.
know, and you know, so I tried to be, you know, as you know, quiet and non-demonstrative as I could be while I was watching the games, but it's just hard. And so I jumped in there and decided to help out. We had a really special group of boys this last year, allowed us to win a state title in 5A and had a pretty magical year for you know, the high school over there in Bend. It was so bad in football 4 years ago to turn it around and go all the way to a state championship. It's a real credit to all of the work that group of young men put in.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but prior to this last season, Summit had never won a playoff game, right? Is that?
They'd never won a playoff game, and 4 years ago, they were, I think they had a streak. It was like an 0-23 streak where they hadn't won a game in a couple of seasons. Just this group of young men came in and decided they were going to change it, and they put in the work. You know, I know that we were blessed to have some good athletes, but these guys were far more than that. They're great students and great community members. I think one of the things that we were most proud of in being a part of that program was that they won a state title, but they also won the academic state championship. They had a team GPA of 3.6, which is quite different than the high school team I was on. I don't know what it was like at your high school coming up, but having a football team that averaged anywhere close to a 3 point would have been a major accomplishment, and these guys. So it was really a cool thing to be a part of.
Drew Bledsoe with us, former Washington State standout, 44,000 passing yards in his pro career. Help people out who are, you know, we've got high school programs that struggle here in the Portland metropolitan area, and people are always like, how do you fix it? So at Summit, what was the big thing that turned that program?
We were able to let's start with this. It was a special group of young men. There's make no mistake about it. This was a unique class of very talented and great kids. But, you know, to me, the most important thing in coaching at any level, but especially at the high school football level, is that guys have to buy into the idea that simply being good at football doesn't cut it. You know, excellence, we try to preach that excellence is a way of life. It's something that you do every day. It's something you do at home, you know, when you're helping out around the house. It's something you do in the classroom. It's something you do in the community. We were able to get these guys to buy into the idea that that if you become an excellent human being and you have great character, that, you know, shows up on the football field. You know, high school sports and youth sports, they're I think the best way to build character, and they're also the best way to reveal character. And so if you're able to convince young people that living a life of excellence is something that they can buy into. Yeah, that doesn't mean, you know, there's only one state champion in each sport every year, so it doesn't guarantee, you know, championships. It doesn't even guarantee wins, but it does guarantee that you're going to make better human beings and kids that are going to be productive members of society going forward.
I was watching film of your kids' junior season, and the thing that strikes me is he's got good feet. And, you know, when I think of Drew Bledsoe, I don't think great feet, but, you know, by standards, you probably did have great feet, but I don't have your film available to me. What does your kid do that you look at and go, man, he does that as well as I did at his age?
The things that he has that set him apart. He's got superior vision, timing, and accuracy, far above where I was, in high school. And he also runs quite a bit better. Let's make no mistake about that.
See, I was being nice. I said he had great feet. I didn't say you.
Thankfully, his mother has some athletic ability, so he can run around a little bit. He throws the ball very, very well. But the things that make him truly unique, particularly as a high school player, you know, are his intelligence and his timing and accuracy and leadership and all of those intangibles, that make a quarterback as opposed to just a thrower. I think he's destined for great things at Northern Arizona. I think it's a great fit for him. It's a great program. They're picked to win the Big Sky this year. I think that the obvious question is, you know, why not wait and see if a D1 school comes in. But the thing that's really different from when I was coming through is that all of these kids commit so early.
Yeah.
And the schools take them so early. And I, you know, if I were to get on a soapbox for just one second,
you're on it.
But that's a change that the NC2A could and should make. I don't think kids should be able to be offered a commitment or give a commitment until they're a senior in high school. I think it's bad for the universities because you know, outside of those true outliers, you know, the LeBron James types or, you know, some of those kind of guys, outside of the true outliers, it's really hard to project for the university what a kid's going to look like in 3 years. And for the kids, I think it puts a lot of pressure on them to, at a very young age, to spend their whole summer going to camps, whether it's basketball or lacrosse or football, whatever it is, to try to get a commitment from a school when they're, you know, 14 or 15 years old. And I just,
yeah.
We chose not to go that route with any of our kids. We chose for them to truly be kids until they got into high school, and that may be part of the reason that bigger offers didn't come in sooner for John. But at the end of the day, it was a choice that we made, and I think it's going to play out very, very well for him. I think he's going to have a lot of fun down in Flagstaff.
How much of that, those conversations that are happening with college coaches, because I'm assuming he's getting letters and, you know, he's weeding through it. How involved did you decide to be in that? How much of that did you leave to John?
You know, ultimately it's got to be his decision. This is his life, and I'm not going to make any decisions for him, but essentially, I approached it the same way that my father approached it when I was going through it. And that was, I was always available to offer opinions when I was asked. And then I also helped him set up a framework for analyzing the different schools, where he has a file that he's kept, you know, now on his phone. I kept mine in a notebook. But he essentially, each time he would go visit a school, He had a list of criteria, and he would rate each school based on all of those different criteria that that we came up with together. So I helped him put together the framework, but the scores and the ratings that he gave those schools were entirely his. But what it did was it allowed him to really look at the different opportunities in sort of an organized way rather than, just a general feeling or, what a coach may say to you. And so my involvement was purely that. It was trying to kind of to help him guide his own decision process, but the decision ultimately always was going to have to be his, and that's the way I believe it should be.
The offense that you guys are running at Summit looks like a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun, and the group of guys that we had last year, and the group of guys that we have coming back this next year, they're all bright guys, and so we were able to do a lot more than most high school offenses in terms of formations and motions and play actions and just a truly diverse offense. Normally, at the high school level, you don't have the time to teach all of that stuff. But because we're blessed with this group, they can handle a lot. You don't have to teach them things multiple times. You can teach it once and they get it. And so it allows us to be really multiple. We had, last year we had, five different position groups and tons of different formations and a lot of motions and all that stuff, and allowed us to be pretty, pretty difficult to defend scheme wise. And then we also had some guys that could really get after it. So it made it a lot of fun to coach. By the time we got to games, it was play calling was pretty easy because we could whatever we chose to do, we could execute it fairly well.
Drew Bledsoe is our guest, Super Bowl champion, four-time Pro Bowler, and the Pac-10 Offensive Player of the Year in 1992. People don't know this about you, but our staff does a lot of research. I know in high school that you were an excellent javelin and discus thrower. Do you follow those events in the Olympic years?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, those throwing events. I would like to go, and I'm obviously not going to Rio this year, but at some point I would like to see some of those events up close and in person. You watch the javelin on television, you don't really get a sense for how far that thing goes in the air. It's really impressive. And the same with the discus, although the discus throwers at the Olympic level are throwing a disc that's quite a bit heavier than what we threw in high school. But, yeah, I'm fired up for the Olympics, man. It's so fun to watch every year, and I'm glad it's at least close to our time zone so we can see some of those things in prime time.
Those guys, I've been in the stadium when they're throwing the javelin. They're throwing at a football field. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Exactly. They're throwing the thing, out there, the length of a football field. And the guys that are great at it, they figure out how to get that thing up there and actually make it fly. It's a pretty amazing event.
You mentioned Rio, and I feel the same way. I'm watching the Olympics. I'm excited for it, but I'm also anticipating like a total disaster. Why do you think nobody's going?
I don't really know, John. I mean, I think that like so many things now in the world, there's so much noise around some things that are not necessarily real.
Yeah.
Like the Zika thing. I get a pretty strong sense that the risk level is probably close to zero. For people that are going down there. Now, I've already had my four kids, and I'm planning on having any more. As a matter of fact, it's impossible for for me now. But I may have a different opinion if I was looking forward to starting a family. I think one thing that happens as a result of all of the noise is that, there's enough attention surrounding it that the powers that be are going to ensure that nothing happens. So because of all that noise, I think it's going to be a very, very safe thing. There's enough attention drawn to it that they can't afford to have anything bad happen.
Yeah, and I think people are using that as an excuse. Like maybe they're tired in their sport and they need some rest, and so they're looking at security and going, I'm not going to go, I just don't feel safe. But the real reason is I think some people want some time off.
Well, you know, if I had just finished an entire NBA basketball season, you know, with the amount of energy that those guys put out, particularly the guys that go, like I know Steph Curry's not going, for example, but the, you know, the beating that a guy like that takes and the energy that he expends through the course of a season and through a seven-game championship series, at the end of that, man, your body does need rest, and I do understand that, you know, if that's the real reason, I think I would prefer that the guys would just come out and truly say that, just like physically I can't take it, rather than using the other excuse. You know, some of the golfers, I know that one kind of bugs me a little bit. I mean, shoot, if you can go play golf in the Olympics for the first time in forever, and let's be honest, some of the guys that are bailing on that, if they're using the Zika virus as an excuse, you know, they can fly plenty of water down on their private planes,
yeah,
and be just fine. So I honestly think that if it were me, if I were choosing, you know, not to go, hopefully I would have the courage to just say, hey, you know what, my body just can't take it, and I've got to rest.
Drew Bledsoe, congratulations to your son. Congratulations on a good season and good wine all summer.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man. Yeah, it's going to be fun, yeah. You know, and on the football side, my two sons are in the same conference. Stu's playing lacrosse, not football. But when they go play Cal Poly, we'll be down there, and then Portland State and Montana State. There'll be a lot of good road trips outside of you know, when we get to go to Flagstaff to watch them fall down there. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
You're listening to the best of the Bald Faced Truth Radio Show. John Canzano, BFT. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Every year we have Sam Weichen on the show. We've had him on this show for a few years here. And he comes on and he's brilliant in speaking with the experience that only a guy who's coached at the highest levels and for the longest time and the kind of teacher that he is as a coach, only a guy like that could talk. And I remember in our last conversation, we kind of talked about all the stuff he had to offer and whether or not he should be writing a book. And now I hear Sam Weich is in fact writing a book. How are you, Coach?
I'm doing fine. I appreciate you coming with a lead on the book. That's good.
Yeah, well,
I'm not sure how many people are going to be interested in that, but I'm hoping enough to repay all my time sitting in front of a typewriter.
Well, we had you.
Computer.
I remember we had you on when Winston and Mariota were preparing for the draft, and you were kind of talking quarterbacks. And I was thinking, this guy needs to be writing a book. You know, you tell stories, and you've got great insight. Do you have a title for the book yet? Do you know what the book's gonna, what direction it's gonna take?
You know, the publisher dictates a lot of that, but one of the titles that we're thinking about is On Borrowed Time: The Sam Weich Story. And it kind of feeds into the narrative. This is not a book about X's and O's or about my one time with my, a period of time within my career at the Bengals or whatever, the Buccaneers. It is from the time I was growing up and the fact that I only had one date in high school, something I'm not sure I was quite ready to share with the world, but it's in there. And then my experience with a abusive dad that, at one time it was my mom screaming at my brother and I to go to the car. Well, we knew what that meant. Get the gun out of the car and get out of my, so my dad couldn't get a hold of it. He was really mad. And, you know, had he got that gun, I don't know. I feel like it was a little bit on borrowed time. And then later on in 1987, for the Bengals, we had a poor year. Paul Brown stuck with me for 88, and we go to the Super Bowl the next year, but that was on borrowed time for sure. Same thing happened in Tampa when Hugh Culverhouse died, and Malcolm Glazier came on, kept me on for one more year to try to get the team ready, and that gave us a chance to draft Warren Sapp and John Lynch and Derek Brooks and get the defense set. We didn't quite have everything in order for the offense, and had a good year, best year they had in 15 years, but wasn't good enough to keep my job. But there was NBC, so on borrowed time again. There's the gist of it.
You know, you mentioned your father in growing up in a household like that, and I know that you've got grandchildren and children of your own. Did that? How do you learn how to be a dad when you have that kind of experience growing up, and that's what that was what was modeled for you?
Well, I had a loving mother and a terrific mom. She used to drag us kicking and screaming up to the Baptist church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, and got us involved in what's called RAs. In those days, I certainly still had it, Royal Ambassadors, which is kind of like Cub Scouts, but church-related. And my dad had a couple of moments where he kind of, you know, come to Jesus moment and tried to reform his way, and didn't last very long. But I learned from those things rather than following that example. And, you know, I think all of us have a chance in life to make choices, and you can either learn from something or you can say, well, that must be the way it is, and that's where I'm going to go. And you generally end up in trouble when you do that.
You mentioned all those times when people believed in you, you know, and the owners especially who believed in you. We had Dick Vermeil on yesterday who said that, you know, if the owner's a scotch drinker, you drink scotch. That's the one guy you really have to coach. When your relationships with owners, how involved were different owners, and how much did you have to kind of manage them?
Well, I was I really believe I was very fortunate. Number one, my first coaching job, the general manager and head coach was Bill Walsh, and Bill was my quarterback coach when I was a rookie in 1968 with the Bengals. I was one of the original Bengal players, and Bill Walsh coached the quarterbacks. The head coach was a legend, you know, Paul Brown, legendary coach. He was the general manager, head coach, and owner of the team. But PB was one of those guys that if you just paid attention, you could learn enough to learn enough football for two or three or four people. And one of the chapters in the books is regrets and satisfaction, some of the regrets. And one of my regrets is I didn't take a styrofoam cup of coffee and walk down to PB's office, Paul Brown's office, every morning that I could, and just sit in front of his desk and say, let her rip, babe. And, you know, whatever's on your mind, I want to hear about it. And in Tampa, as the head coach, had a great owner in Hugh Culverhouse, who contracted cancer shortly. I mean, about 3 months after he hired me. And so most of that was around, most of my career with him was around his fight against cancer, and we centered on that and a lot of charity events and worked together. And so I had good experiences. And Malcolm Glazier was a terrific guy, is, so he still is, but he was a terrific guy with me, and I have no regrets. I am very lucky. I tell people sometimes I have at least 2 shares, maybe 3 shares of good fortune because of the way my career has gone. Somebody's walking around with no luck at all as a result, of course.
Coach,
could that be you? You're laughing like, oh my gosh, is that where my luck is?
I mean, I just think that's great perspective, and you probably didn't have that as a young coach coming into the league, and it's something you get over time.
If you're not getting smarter over time, then you are really stupid. I mean, that is, I tell people that one of the most important, if not the most important word in sports, is being observant. The first quarterback that I coached in the NFL was Joe Montana back in 1979. We drafted him out of Notre Dame, and he was a rookie player. I was a rookie coach, but I learned as much from Joey as he learned from me. So probably a lot more I learned from Joe, but and then I could pass that on to Boomer Esiason and Drew Bledsoe and Vinny Testaverde and all the quarterbacks that I was fortunate enough to coach later on. Good coaches are good teachers. Coaching is teaching. And if you can't teach involves communicating to the point that they remember what you're trying to say to them. If you are a good observer, you can pass on a lot of good details to the next guy without having to read a lot of books.
Coach, the idea that you learn from observing, I'm curious when you're looking at, as a coach, when you're looking at a young quarterback, we have all this evaluation stuff like the combine and game film that you see kids in college. How much time ideally do you need to be around a quarterback, watch him practice, talk to him, to really understand if this is a guy who's going to get it?
You know, that's an excellent question, by the way. I've never actually thought about that. Everybody's a little different for openers. Some people, with Joe Montana, for example, if I was saying something to Joe, a coaching comment to Joe, his technique of listening was he would start to invade your space. He would start to lean in, literally take a step or two towards you, you know, slowly and surely. Wasn't about to jump you or anything. He was just trying to listen real hard. But if you didn't hurry up and get the coaching point finished, he'd eat the last syllable right off your lip. He was that kind of a guy. So some guys are eager to learn. And Joe had the added quality of if you told him one thing on the next play, he would do it that way. And then the play after that, he'd do it that way. And then the next day, he would do it that way. And game day, he would do it that way. Well, those kind of guys, you can adjust in game situations. You can switch the game plan around a little bit without throwing them a curveball. But there are other guys that Boomer Esiason was probably the best field general that I can remember being around, as much as Joe is right on his heels, probably. But Boomer would go out there and take command. And he almost knew what I was about to say to him before I said it and would finish the sentence for me lots of times and go out there and coach the rest of the team in the huddle about how we were going to run this play the next time around. So everyone's a little bit different, but you better have good, smart players. I have a motto that the team that has the best healthy players has the best chance to win. You might want to write that down because that's pretty important, pretty deep right there. But and that's true, you know. But they've got to be smart, and obviously they've got to be good athletes, good and have skills in their position. But then they better be healthy. You got to keep them healthy. That's the last, I'd say, 6, maybe 7 years of my head coaching career. I didn't go 2-a-days. I would go light in the morning in shorts and T-shirts. We'd install. We wouldn't run full speed. We would install what we were going to put in that day. And then that afternoon, we'd go with pads. And then that night, we would install the next day's plays and defensive coverages and special teams, plays and coverages as well. But you better leave them fresh leg. You better leave them still full of energy on opening day. I can remember lots of times on opening day throughout my playing career that I felt like I'd played 2 seasons already, because we would go sometimes 3 practices a day, and your legs were like rubber, and your attention span was just cut in half. You were just so fatigued.
The NFL in that time, and when you come into the league as a player in the late 60s and then play through the mid 70s, how different was that game than the game you were coaching years later?
Well, right off the bat, the first thought that comes to me as an offensive player, quarterback, is that the defensive fronts and the defensive coverages were much simpler. You would generally see a 4-man front. Every now and then you'd see a 3-man front, 34 defense. So when you hear quarterbacks talking, they'll say 34. Well, that means there's 3 down linemen and 4 linebackers. Or what we saw in the 60s and early 70s were 43 defenses, 4 down linemen and 3 linebackers. And they would maybe shift the nose or the tackles around on the shoulders of the guards, and that would be the only wrinkle in their front. And in the coverage, you'd see a free safety in the middle with 3-deep zone or 3-deep man coverage with really only 1-deep, because you had everybody on the corners had a man-to-man. And then occasionally you'd see cover 2 grew into it, but it was easy to identify because suddenly instead of having 1 safety, you had 2. Well, in today's game, they're all over the place. And you don't know whether the safety's coming and they're dropping the defensive end, or whether they're bringing 3 people to one side and only 1 from the other. It's just an entirely different strategy defensively. Offensively, of course, the no-huddle changed a lot of things. You had to adjust defensively on the run on that one. And I think you're seeing more of a wide-open game. The passing game has become more and more not only saleable, the fans love it, but it's a way to get the big chunks of yardage and get back into a game if you're down.
When you're done with your NFL coaching career, you end up at Pickens High School as the quarterback's coach and later the offensive coordinator. And I've got to ask, as you're coaching those kids, and were you a substitute teacher too? Is that right?
Yeah, I did. I loved it. I tell you, I recommend that anybody that is retired sign up to be a substitute teacher. They will teach you an entirely new world book encyclopedia. I'm telling you, they got it. Today's youth growing up in a totally different environment, much more dangerous, not just for drugs or guns or anything else, just the rules of teaching, keeping God out of the schools. Well, he's our last hope and our best hope, and that's the first thing that seems school boards want to keep out. So you've got to be willing to deal with all of that, but I recommend that highly. Boy, it's not only is it fun, but it's rewarding.
I mean, and did the kids realize that this is a guy who coached in the Super Bowl that is standing in the front of the room, or how long did it take them to figure that out?
Not long, because I took those rings in there to shut them up. I have three Super Bowl rings, and they broadcast a fourth, but you don't get a ring for that. But I had three, and I would bring all three of them in there and dazzle them with the diamonds. And I'm an amateur magician as well. I've been doing magic for probably 50 years, 45 years. And I'd go in there, and I'll do a magic trick. Now, this one I'm substitute teaching. It's when you walk in there as a substitute teacher, the kids start rubbing their hands together saying, oh, man, fresh meat. This is going to be fun today. And so I'll pull out a rope and then have somebody, you know, cut it in half. We'll tie it back together, and then I'll splash some invisible dust on it, and all of a sudden the rope's back whole again. And they're all saying, how do you do that? And I'll tell them, well, if you'll be quiet, put your cell phones away, pay attention to what we are talking about, we'll call timeout, we'll have a halftime show, and we'll have some more fun with this. And kids, I think, if they know they got something to look forward to, they will pay attention. They will try to be rewarded, for that attention with something that's fun or at least entertaining.
What is it about magic that drew you to it?
Say it again.
What about magic drew you to it, you know, for 50 years?
I was early in my life, I was involved with Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Furman University. I didn't have a summer job my sophomore year, and a coach named Jackie Powers said, we have one scholarship left to Black Mountain, North Carolina. And I said, well, I came up with 1,000 excuses why I couldn't go, wouldn't go, and none of them passed the test. And so I went to that, and there was a fellow there named Bunny Martin, who you, I bet, won't remember, but Bunny was the world yo-yo champion at one time. Now it's all coming back to you, I guess. Maybe not. Okay. Well, Bunny Martin was an amateur magician as well as a semi-professional yo-yo artist, and he would do both. And I just got fascinated in the illusion. You know, I saw that, and there's no way that three of diamonds can be the king of spades now, but I saw it, and I'm standing right here next to him, and I just got infatuated with it. When I went to Cincinnati in 1968, there was a magic shop who made magic apparatus and sold it, for a business. And I made a deal with this fellow that I'll trade you tickets for secrets. You tell me how to make a coin disappear in my hand, and I'll get you 2 tickets to the Cleveland game. And from that point forward, I guess I probably spent another couple of $1,000 figuring out how to make that coin disappear.
I looked up Bunny Martin, and I didn't know his name, but I know who you're talking about. Everybody's seen that guy, and you know, it was with the yo-yos and the magic tricks.
Yeah, and funny, a lot of comedy, a lot of audience participation, that kind of thing. He just had the whole ball of wax going, and I used to say to myself, boy, I wish I could do that sometime, and so I started pattering my delivery when I was speaking in different places after him, and literally, seriously, buying more and more tricks and buying more and more apparatus. And I bet I had a couple of $1,000 in it when I was traded from Cincinnati. Thank goodness they traded me. I would have come out with a net zero worth out of football.
All right, Coach, we wish you the best with the book. When it comes out, we'd love to get you back on to promote it. Can't wait to read it. Thank you for making time.
Hey, thanks for having me, and I can't wait to get on that West Coast out there.
All right.
Everything's 3 hours late. Okay.
Talk to you later. All right, Coach. There he is. Sam Weich, former coach with the Bengals and the Buccaneers. Great stuff from him. A lot of wisdom there.
Thank you for listening to the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.